Absolute pleasure to be here. I thought we would just kick off with some really quick intros. At Earthly, you know, we're really focused on accelerating funding to nature protection and restoration. And I'm also really personally interested about how we can communicate the kind of the climate and the nature situation. And so I think music is a great avenue to do that. So I'm really excited to kind of dig in a bit deeper into how we can achieve that.
I'm Supriya Nagarajan, based in Yorkshire, and I'm primarily a vocalist and a composer. So I have the good fortune of singing my own compositions, which immensely helps, of course. My interest in climate change has been quite recent, the last 4 or 5 years, really, although it's been bubbling in the back of my head. And so this conversation has been especially relevant. My composition extends mainly to my primary style, which is Indian classical music. That's what I was trained in. And so I use that as the basis for any of the commissions that I fulfill.
I'm Colin Riley. I guess I've been composing as long as I can remember. I'm living in Cumbria, having sort of recently moved out of the big city. I think that nature and composers has always been a thing. It's always been around. And I think as in any artist, you're kind of bound a little bit to trying to represent your times. And I think so many composers now are involved with creating music that somehow asks people to listen a bit differently and engage with issues. So it's lovely to be a part of this because we all get to discuss things together and composers together is always a nice thing. It's nice to meet with colleagues. So I'm looking forward to this and hearing about other people's ways in and other people's relationship to this important issue.
Hi, I'm Angela Elizabeth Slater. I'm also a composer, of course, originally from Nottinghamshire. And now I'm sort of moved from the East Midlands to the dizzying heights of the West Midlands, now based in Staffordshire. And my music often actually is sort of related to the natural world. And that's sort of how I've come to sort of be naturally inclined to have aspects of it related to climate change. But also my music often is sort of related to sort of visual arts and dance and poetry. And sometimes I even write some of my own or paint some of my own artworks as a way of sort of bringing whatever I'm trying to compose into focus through like a different art form as well. And yeah, so I'm just looking really forward today to talk about my different works and hearing about Colin and Supriya's different works and how they relate to nature and climate change as well.
Be fascinating to perhaps kick off looking at your personal journeys and perhaps the kind of inspiration that you draw from. And so, Supriya, you know, was there a specific kind of moment or an experience that made you want to incorporate climate change into your compositions?
So my background is that I'm an accountant who gave up accountancy in 2005 to become a full-time musician composer. So that's where I've sort of traveled in my journey. I just wanted to go back to the beginning and sort of give you a focus on where I started. So 2005 was when I actually immersed myself in music. And I meandered through a number of options, you know, so commissions coming my way, performing. I enjoyed every aspect of the journey. But in climate change has always been sort of in the back of the brain simply because I travel a lot, not only with work, but also on a personal basis. So I've always thought about the carbon footprints and, you know, thought about it and minimized it where I could. But into 2015, there was a personal tragedy when the glaciers in the Himalayas melted and actually submerged the town of Kedarnath, which is on the foothills, which has never happened before. This is the first time in the history. And that just brought into focus, and so we lost somebody, the family lost somebody there. And that just brought into focus the fact that things have moved on quite rapidly. It's not something that's going to happen in the distant future, but it's going to happen now. And, you know, every little matters. And that's why climate change came into my music. And I started to think elementally about the about climate change and deal with it. Also because my roots help me to do that. So, you know, I'm a practicing Hindu. So mythological stories from India, all the scriptures, they all contribute to actually being used or used as a focus to concentrate my music on. So I sort of use all those aspects of my identity and music making to talk about climate change. And obviously, we'll talk a little bit more about what I'm doing, but that's where my climate change focus came in. and I'm very much on the journey now.
It's so interesting, like often with extreme weather changing, when we experience firsthand, you know, the effects, it can be a real kind of sort of trigger to, you know, stimulate our involvement in this space. And Colin, you know, how do you see the role of music in raising awareness or even inspiring action for kind of climate issues?
Yeah, it's kind of complicated in many ways, because many people are aware of the climate crisis. And sometimes as composers, we can feel quite small, quite tiny. But I guess we all have a role to play, and that could be in our personal lives and the way we lead them. But it could be through trying to make some small incremental change with the way people view the world. I mean, I've been a composer as long as I can remember. I think that's what I said in the introduction. It's part of the fabric of what I do. But I've been thinking a lot about the climate for a long time. And I've been a teacher all my life. And those things kind of work together, I think, when you see that the way that people view the world now, particularly young people, there's a lot of mental health issues. You know, there's a climate crisis, but there's a mental crisis, I think, as well. People talk about climate grief, don't they? There's not been an epiphany for me. I think it's a gradual kind of daily kind of thing that keeps building up. And I think as composers, we can do these small things. Music has this huge magical power, which we mustn't forget. It has a very strong place, or it should have a very strong place in the world and in education. Discuss about whether people have kind of got that yet. It does bring us together, and it's just good for us, isn't it? I mean, music is good for us. So if it can foster a way that we can listen, and I guess a kind of sensitivity to what's around us, instead of this, if it can counterbalance the decreasing concentration span and reliance on a digital format, let's say, if we can get back to nature, we can listen more fully. It's going to be a good thing. And so my kind of way into all this is to try and tickle the ear a little bit and the ideas around climate crisis and sort of get people listening in a different way, get them listening intently. If they're noticing things, if they are aware of the details and of inconsequential things as much as the things that are shouting loud to them, we kind of stand a chance that that people might care, right? And if people care, we've got something to build on. So that's kind of my approach, I guess, of my small role as a composer.
I think your point around music bringing people together is such an important value that it can add. Angela, in your introduction, you were talking about the influence that nature's had on your music. You know, how's it influenced your compositional voice and even the kind of the structure of the music that you're composing?
As a composer, I feel like deeply passionate about the exploring like intricate connections between music and the world around us. And as I said, that I often inspired and influenced by nature, and I sort of feel like I often actually musically map aspects of the natural world into the fabric of my music. I've been doing this for many years, sort of using the idea of different natural phenomenon as either just sort of a poetic inspiration, or sort of even going down to the sort of structural architecture of the work, even influencing the gestural language and the micro and macro structures of a work. For example, quite an old orchestral piece now called Roll in Stillness is based completely on the structure of a ripple. I imagined a pebble falling into water, and then I zoomed in my mind of like all the kind of cascade of ripplets and things that came out. I have pieces such as the Moon Runs Red, which is about the lunar eclipse and sort of how the different color light lengths get kind of cast off to finally come around to the red color. And, you know, I have over 120 works at this point, and the vast majority of them have some either explicit link to the natural world or sort of poetic link to the natural world. I have a couple of works that are more explicitly about climate change. One that I called Non-Existent, which is a piece for a voice, an ensemble. I created my own text, which juxtaposed the text of climate change scientists and activists. I quoted, you know, Greta Thunberg and people like that, as well as climate change deniers, because it was often quite interesting how absurd it would be that some of the sort of beginning of sentences would be really similar, you know, the destruction of the planet, the destruction of our industries and things like this. So it was sort of just to bring light to that in that particular piece in a more explicit way.
Love to kind of just look at a bit more into the creative process and musical expression. Supriya, you know, how does your creative process sort of change when you're drawing inspiration from, you know, environmental themes like, say, water or air?
The journey starts with going back to my roots, my identity as an Indian musician who studied classical South Indian music, Carnatic music. I always anchor from that platform. Because, for example, the raga music lends itself to different times of the day, different emotions. So for me, I draw upon all those influences to actually create a piece of work. I created a piece of work called Meltwater in 2023. The way the music formed with some wonderful collaborators that I had, one, it was completely improvised. And two, all the ragas that I selected were based on the times of the day. So the whole premise of that particular show was the melting of a glacier and how gradual it is. So there was a movie that accompanied the particular show. And for 60 minutes, the movie is so gradual. It was actually a 3-minute film that was stretched with AI into a 60-minute film. So you can imagine how gradually the things changed in that movie. Unless you saw the bird actually flutter, you thought it was a still. And then, of course, the glacier caved in the end. But the whole journey was about the glacier waking up in the morning and going to sleep at night. So I selected the ragas that were appropriate to those times of the day. And, you know, all my collaborators who are wonderful improvisers could pick up on the, you know, rudiments of the notes of the raga and work with me to actually improvise on stage. So we've done that a few times, and each time it's a different kind of vibe, which is really interesting because it lends itself to the space. So that's how I look at my compositions. So I provide a structure and a background and sort of an inspiration for improvising collaborators to work on with me.
That's fantastic. Anjali, you were talking about your pieces earlier, and I'd love to kind of dig in a bit deeper. And, you know, could you maybe describe how a specific piece, like Through the Fading Hour or The Louder Than Birds Sing, reflects climate change within the theme of the song?
A lot of my music has sort of two layers, sort of have perhaps a more immediate image and then a sort of second layer. And I think Through the Fading Hour, which is a concerto for viola, essentially is sort of trying to evoke imagery of like light colors and light qualities, a literal twilight, the onsetting of, you know, darkness and the fading of light. But it's also, for me, a second layer of sort of the twilight hour of Earth, or at least Earth, how we know it with our presence on it. This was sort of me thinking about what's going on with the climate crisis, but also sort of atrocities around the world that I felt like as though we are somehow in this kind of time where everything's sort of tipping over into what will become essentially probably the destruction of humankind. Not to be too melodramatic, I'd like to think Earth itself would survive afterwards. So that's sort of the light topic of Through the Fading Hour. And then The Louder the Birds Sing, it's about essentially the emotional turmoil of the pandemic, and sort of both exploring our strength and fragility and fragility. And it was about a phenomenon that people observed during lockdown, of the idea that people thought they could hear the birds louder during the time, which is hence the title, The Louder the Birds Sing. And it was sort of this kind of disconcerting realization for me that the more that we thought we could hear the birds sing, the more dire our current situation in the COVID pandemic was. But then there was this kind of other tension that because we sort of removed our human presence from these spaces, you know, less traffic fumes, less noise, more room for nature, that it was also wonderful in a way. So it's sort of this kind of tension of both crises sort of coming together to sort of, well, just through this observation of the birds being heard more at that time.
Colin, you know, what role do you think, you know, your music plays in almost creating kind of empathy and sensitivity towards nature?
It's been fascinating to hear Supriya and Anjali talk about some of their music, and the connections we all have. I mean, there are big themes that I think we are attracted to as composers. You know, water is definitely one of them. For obvious reasons, bird song, dusk and changes of light and times of day. Definitely all sorts of things in my work. But I was also interested to hear, Angela, you talking about when you've created pieces, you kind of zoom in a little bit. And also, Sophia, your gradual transformations. Again, these are big, kind of powerful ways that we work, and with your Meltwater piece. Other colleagues here have answered some of the questions. But I mean, to add further to that, apart from the fact that I also use a lot of water references, the idea of place, perhaps, is also one that's been important for me over the last 10 years or so. And the idea that if we can sort of hear and feel and empathize with a place that we're in, we're going to kind of value that, whether it's a sort of our immediate surroundings or a place that we go to, a place for worship or a place for self-communing, you know, in like a mountain or something. These are all important touchstones for us, I think. And for composers in the past, they've been important. But I mean, to talk specifically, which I think is part of what we want to do today, there have been several big pieces of mine that look at place. They all seem to have the word place in them as well. So there was a sort of album of songs called In Place, where I was collaborating with writers who were commissioned to create their own response, and then I would respond to their response. But the one that I think would be interesting to talk about, perhaps, is a piece I composed for the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, and it was premiered, I think, a couple of years ago, which is called Hearing Places. And for me, that title, as simple as it is, has this richness about it, which is all around this idea that I find, particularly if you can kind of immerse yourself somehow, it's a kind of meditation, I suppose, you are somehow celebrating, whether it's just your backyard in the sunlight or the top of a mountain or sitting by a river or whatever, or in an urban square. Just it's really a rich thing. It's I want to try and make people particularly through this piece, that Hearing Places, perhaps reconnect with that, and through that reconnection there's going to be some spark and some catalyst, I suppose, for change eventually. So really what I did in that piece was I wandered around Wales and found all sorts of places to immerse myself in, stood or sat or lay down and with the recorder, and literally spent loads of time just recording, sometimes with the headphones on, sometimes not. Sometimes I just got wind on the recorder because I forgot to put the muffler on. And sometimes I found myself slightly transported and transformed through that meditation with the place itself. I went back and used all those recordings and found a way to sort of integrate them, long story short, within the orchestral fabric. And so it became a piece about Wales and places in Wales. But more importantly, it was a piece about the kind of archetypes of places that we find inspiration, solace, or we're in awe of. And I think, or I hope at least, that kind of approach might contribute to some kind of awareness of all these beautiful things and that we could or are starting to lose through the climate crisis.
I think it's a really interesting area. I think the term is biophilia.
Yes.
When you kind of listen to nature and you have that, you know, you have that kind of connection to nature. Recently, I've been speaking to people about like where their happy place is in life. And it's pretty much 99% is within nature as well, which is really interesting that we have that deep connection, you know, to it. So
there's a lovely book I was reading at the time, actually. It's called Losing Eden, which is by Lucy Jones. I'm sure Angela will say the same thing. Things we read as well kind of turn us on to ideas and ways that we might work. I mean, I'm not just talking about poetry, but books written about climate and about nature.
Thank you. I've made a note, not added to my list. I'd love to move on to looking at music's impact on audiences and perhaps wider society. And Sapria, have you noticed any significant reactions or feedback from audiences related to your work's climate themes that you could share with us?
Meltwater had a really good reception. It was about water as a disruptor. And I had a fantastic collaborator from the Leeds University, Professor Natasha Barlow. And it was really helpful to have somebody in there who is an academic expert, who actually knows the subject And it was interesting because we both found the collaboration very, very useful to reach out to people and audiences in a slightly different way because, you know, you can speak and within the same vacuum for a long time. And, you know, you are talking to people who are converted. So Natasha found it interesting as well because we have now reached out to a cross-section of people that otherwise would not be at her lectures or her conferences and vice versa, because a lot of the university staff and students came across for the concert at Opera North. So reaching out to cross-sections is something that I'm focusing on with the work because I know that there are people that who love what I do in terms of the music who will come and attend the performances or compositions that I make. But it is about how do you reach the people who otherwise would not step through the door. So that's been a little bit of where I'm putting my concentration on these days. Recently, I was in India, in Jaipur, and realized that in the 5 years that I've been in Jaipur, the air quality, for example, has changed so dramatically. What I did was to have conversations because I'm developing a piece on breath and air. So what I did was to actually have conversations with a lot of people from different strata of society. It could be authors, it could be the auto drivers, the rickshaw drivers who took me around here, there, everywhere. Talk to people to understand whether they have any awareness of climate change. What do they think about tackling climate change through a different route, whether it's music, walks, it could be a different books, reading, what do they think? And I find that there is a lot of awareness among audiences now. They are very, very receptive to the idea that the younger generation needs to be aware of how to save the planet. So, I mean, you would think that people are not, doing things on a daily basis, but they are within their little bubbles. And all these little things help. So we had these absolutely wonderful discussions, which will now inform what I'm going to be doing next with my piece. But also, it also emphasized to me the urgency of what needs to be done. It's about doing it and not expecting anything immediately. And so, I mean, I've sort of created the audiences before the works even started because everybody is really interested in exploring it through the idea of music and poetry and sounds and, you know, that whole journey. So, yeah, I think the audiences are ready and especially keen to influence the younger members of their own community. So I'm very positive on that.
Wonderful. Thank you. Colin, you make commitments as a vegetarian and a non-flyer. Now, how do those choices influence your work and perhaps your audience perception of your work as well?
That's a bit of a complicated one, really. What you do as a composer is trying to invite a reaction from somebody who you hope might be listening. And what you do in your life, they are connected. But sometimes there's an action you take in your life and something you actually just do. For me, I mean, apart from the fact that I felt it was important to state those two things for this debate, they're not things that I really talk about. I action them rather than talk about them. If I shouted at work, it would go contrary, I think, to some of the things I've talked about in terms of sort of finding a way in and finding your own place and helping people to find that place. In a way, they don't have any relationship to my work in an exact sense, except that obviously what you are as a person changes what you create. I mean, I'm pretty dogged with some of those things. I mean, when it came to having performances in Europe and a piece in Sweden, which was a kind of climate piece. It was called Earth Voices for orchestra. And there was no way I was going to fly over there. So I made it part of the process. I had to go over there and back a few times for rehearsals and for initial meeting and for a performance. And it's 2 days there and 2 days back. But I was kind of pretty dogged with that. And I thought it was just important for me, but actually I thought maybe it was an important statement to make as well somehow about music. And feeling, or at least personally, that the conflict of flying, et cetera. So these are really hard things to talk about, actually, because I don't normally want to get involved with this discussion because musicians, it's a difficult one. If you're trying to earn a living and it's a lot cheaper to fly than it is to go on a train. I mean, discuss why that is. But I mean, it's part of my work, but it's also not, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, no, I totally understand that. And I think, yeah, hopefully we'll get to a point in the not too distant future where also rail fares are cheaper
Yeah, would be good. Yeah,
in airline flights. Angela, you know, moving to you, maybe we could dig into the connection to the natural world that it's created among the musicians and listeners.
Yes, well, I really hope it has managed to create a deeper connection to nature for, you know, my musicians and listeners. But I mean, I think music is really sort of poetry and metaphor, and it has an ability to immerse us into another world, allow us to imagine things that perhaps we wouldn't normally do in our day-to-day lives. And so music gives us this chance to perceive our world and our environment through a different lens, to comment upon it and our view of it through immersion. And so I think I'm, with each piece, I'm trying to set up a world in which people are hopefully transported to a different place, and they can begin to imagine these places, and they're inspired by the beauty of and magnificence of nature, and perhaps also draw the parallels that, you know, to varying extents in my program notes that I sort of pull them towards, of, you know, things that are sort of, I suppose, climate change adjacent, and sort of feel the importance of these phenomena and these places, and sort of take their own readings from the works.
I think what one of the things that we often talk about is the importance of collaboration in this space. So I'd love to just spend a moment on that. Supriya, could you maybe share how collaboration with other sectors has perhaps influenced your environmental storytelling in your music?
I think it's been crucial, Ollie. It's been one of the, you know, pillars of any climate change work. I discovered that making a piece of music or performance, composition, after receiving a brief, is fairly straightforward. You identify collaborators, you identify people that you want to work with, and you make it happen. But with climate change, it's not the responsibility for me as the performer or the composer or both, is not only to deliver something, but also to pass the message on wider. So I've realized that the more the cross-cultural, cross-curricular, cross-disciplinary aspect of the work, the further it will reach. So it's almost like a social responsibility that I've taken on to make sure that my collaborators are from different spheres of life. And to that extent, I had Natasha, who was academic. It was the first foray into having somebody from a university actually work with me on the piece as a consultant. And now, for my next piece, I have doctors from the NHS who are actually specialists in airway management, because if it's about breath, if it's about air pollution, then I really want to see the impact on the lungs. So I have academics as well as I have doctors, and all these people inform the work. So they are highly fascinated by the idea that whatever they are actually giving me in terms of information or consultancy or help, or even just, you know, just some brainstorming, really, that is actually informing how I actually present the music, and that therefore is going to reach out to people. So they are both my audience, they are both my consultants, as well as they are my test guinea pigs, so that I can actually test the work on them and say, is it making an impact? Is it influencing what you do in any way, shape or form? And it's a very abstract thing, and it takes a lot of time and energy to collaborate fully, because these are people that don't actually work in music on a day-to-day basis. But I'm finding this whole journey is really exciting, because the more you have collaborators from the different parts of society, I think the further the message reaches.
I can imagine, because they're not in music day to day, that their perspective is quite different. So it kind of gives you a refreshing input into your work as well.
And it also leaves an impact on them as, you know, collaborators. They have never thought of themselves as being anything but what they do. And so for them, this is something that is, out of the box. And anything out of the box is interesting. So I think it's achieving a lot of things consciously and unconsciously. Very interesting.
I couldn't agree with what Supriya just said more about kind of the diversity and the whole makeup of collaborations. So if I could say that first. because it does, it changes you as a member of a team or a group. You kind of lose the ego a little bit, which is always going to be good. And you realize that you've got one kind of point of view as an art maker. So certainly working with scientists means that you realize you see the world differently. And that's why, precisely for that very reason, arts and science can work really well together, and why it's being kind of promoted a lot. There's kind of opportunities and grants and things for art and science to collide, because it creates this kind of complexity. It's time consuming, and you often don't understand the language that each other is using. I'm currently sort of working on a project which, probably as every composer is at the moment, using AI in some form, but just because it's current, I suppose. But it's also encroaching. It has impact, I think, on this discussion, AI, because it's, you can see it as the antithesis of what I've said earlier about immersing yourself in nature. What people are just doing more and more is immersing themselves in front of a screen and in some digital world, which could be weird and wonderful and fascinating, but is very different and does different things to your brain and your whole makeup. But I have been working on some AI, and I found that fascinating because it was a learning for me about some of the science behind it. It challenges you to work differently and to think differently. And I think as composers, we can fall back on the techniques we have, and we'll write another piece. And you know, you often think, I don't know if you guys think that as well, but you often think, does the world need another piece from me? You know, right? There's plenty that exists that need a second performance. So I think quite hard about the next piece I'm writing. And the idea of collaborating and understanding through science is a great way, I think, of it changing me. And that's kind of important. If it can change me, maybe I'm going to say something a bit more succinctly or in a different way.
You've made some really good points, and I think we could probably do a separate session exclusively on AI.
It was a project actually about birds, which I forgot to say in all that ramble, because we were looking at how far a digital thing and its algorithms and whatever, its machine learning, approach anything near something that's perceived as beautiful in nature. That's kind of the question. And so far the answer is no. But I mean, you know, watch this space. The piece isn't finished yet, and AI is developing really rapidly. But it raised some really interesting points for me about the idea of beauty. And I'm putting together another big project, which is specifically about what is beauty and how that can manifest itself in both the natural world, the created musical world, and digital.
I also see with nature and maths in nature, and the maths almost in music, the parallels there, which are really, you know, really, really interesting.
Mathematicians talk about maths being beautiful in a very sort of abstract way, or a way that I can't understand, right? Not being a mathematician, but I hear that said, which is really interesting.
How does one balance kind of conveying these environmental themes without overwhelming or even, you know, preaching to one's audience?
Yeah, I do end up thinking about this a lot in my work, not even just in my environmental stuff. I've been doing more politically charged works, and I sort of try and lay these things out without necessarily trying to tell people what to think, even if it's clear what I think. And I mean, obviously, I was saying a lot of these works are to do with like phenomenon in nature. I think actually my interest in that actually comes from my background, in that I actually used to be a scientist for a very brief period of time. I started a pharmacy degree, which I promptly swapped to music. Even though I've long forgotten a lot of the foundations of science, I think they still sort of hold in my fascination. And I think when people are listening to my music, they get that from it, that they can tell that I'm really interested in the topic, and that's really inspired it. And yes, there may be these links to climate change, but I'm not sort of saying, you know, change your behavior, do this, do that. So it's more about bringing them again into that immersive space where they can appreciate the environment, and then they can consider if I'm perhaps bringing them there slightly along the way about the impact of ourselves, how we can end up destroying these places. But I'm not necessarily shoving it in their faces. I'm allowing them to sort of, yeah, consider these things sort of more through the, I suppose, inspiration of the places or the phenomenon. Let them decide what they want to think and do in their own lives.
That makes sense. I think the psychology as well is really fascinating, and there's a lot of negativity, but also a lot of positive things happening. And you know, we choose to focus on the positive developments and the positive progress and projects out there, and find that that's, we can almost kind of get more of a connection with the people we're talking to by focusing on that side. What key opportunities do you see for composers to advocate for climate action through music?
I think everybody has to take responsibility within their own work or life to advocate the message a little bit. Because, you know, if we want to leave a planet for the future generations that is reasonable and sustainable and has the same resources that we have enjoyed in our lifetime, then we have to do that little bit. I think working in climate change as a composer is quite an exciting as well as a very important role currently. It hasn't been something that has happened in the past as urgently as it's happening now. I mean, nature, like Angela and Colin said, nature and has always, environment has always inspired compositions, but it's become a slightly more urgent advocacy now. So I think that's our role. I mean, you have to put the message out there and let it reach. You can't force it, but you have to put the message out. So that's how I see the role of composers going forward in the future.
Like with any area of composer's work, but this one particularly, you've got to make the work part of you and you part of the work a little bit. But you've also got to, you've got to do it your way. If you want to shout and be angry, then you should shout and be angry and as a composer. And if you want to do something quietly, you should do it quietly. If you want to make long pieces, if you want to be political, you should be political. I think you just be yourself, because it needs all those voices. It needs all that variety of composers. And I'm sure we all probably consider ourselves similar in the fact that we're working in the climate crisis area. But we probably see ourselves as very different composers as well. And that's as it should be, you know. And I think composers should speak as clearly as they can, whatever that means in their work. Speak clearly and do it your way.
Yeah, I think, you know, different composers will find different opportunities to sort of continue this message. A lot of my work where, you know, perhaps I just reach a couple of audience members through the immersion of the sort of natural world spaces, and that perhaps changes a few minds and things. As I said, I mentioned sort of a few more political works. I've got some more sort of explicitly climate change sort of inspired works, and maybe those where I'm making much more of a kind of definite statement might also reach some people and audiences and just make them think about how they're living their lives. But yeah, we just have to keep continuing making our art, how we, like Colin said, how we make our art, whether quietly or loudly or a bit of both, as we, you know, navigate different topics and things. But yeah, the main thing is to keep going.
What do you do when you feel frustrated at the lack of ability to hear climate change urgency in your listenership, audiences or commissioners? Humans are tone deaf by choice or saturated and disabled by the inability to make an actual impact. So audience often do not hear those nuances in the music.
That's a tough question, right? That's a really tough question. It's back to the heart of what we are as composers. I mean, we're partly entertainers, but if you can make something interesting and accessible enough, people are going to stick with it. But there's huge frustration. Audiences more and more are being fed what the gatekeepers, I suppose, maybe feel is what's needed. And the rest of the time, they're in an echo chamber of algorithms where they're listening to the same thing that's like something else. So it's very frustrating, I think, to think that you want to get something out that might be really important and get people to listen to it in a certain way. So that's my feeling. There certainly is frustration, but it fuels the fact that you need to be ever more clear and direct with your message, I guess, for the way that you tickle the ear with getting people's interest.
I think the thing that helps sometimes live performances especially is to have a Q&A at the end with a few of the collaborators. And what that does is, if the audience have not received the whole message, then that's their opportunity to ask. And if someone else asks the question, then it gets clarified. So it has helped to some extent, but like Colin says, you know, you can put the message out and hope that it's received well. And also hope that if it's not, then there'll be questions asked that can actually clarify things. So, I mean, this is over to the audience in many ways.
Picking up on a point that Colin sort of made is about gatekeepers and commissioners. They're so sort of blown by the political wind You know, one moment it's kind of fashionable to be a climate change composer, then the next it's not. And that's sort of frustrating that it's not actually like linked to what's important. It's just, what they think will get bums on seats, I guess. It would be, well, it's sort of changing the whole political wind, but also trying to like to think that these gatekeepers wouldn't be so easily swayed. But I'm not quite sure when that's going to happen.
To kind of wrap things up, you know, I'd love to look to the future. And are there any specific projects or themes that you're planning to explore, you know, regarding climate change?
Actually, probably the next piece I'm going to be working on just happens to be a piece that is going to be very explicitly about climate change. It's going to be quite an unusual piece for horn and electronics. The electronics section is going to be sort of a mixture of multimedia kind of quotes and voices of female environmentalists from the past. So people like Rachel Carson, you know, the writer of Silent Spring, and Jane Goodall, Wangari Maathai, sort of other, you know, social, environmental and political activists, and sort of bringing both a feminist, environmentalist sort of light to these people's work from the past. And it's also, I guess, demonstrate that there's actually such a long sort of legacy of people working on this topic, and it still somehow hasn't been heard. I mean, it has been heard, but it still hasn't been heard. So this is, yeah, a piece that's going to really sort of highlight all their great work.
Sounds wonderful. If you've got space, you have to squeeze in Sylvia Earle as well. She's a real hero of mine. And Colin and Supriya, anything planned from you?
I am continuing my journey on, like I said, the elemental exploration of climate. So air, of course, is the next thing, as I mentioned, lungs and, you know, working with air pollution. But I'm also looking at forest fires. We have seen forest fires across the world, in Greece and in Los Angeles. And there's a lot of work that's happening on that. But I just wanted to get back to, you know, what used to be in place in Australia, for example, that has now been lost. So it's about lost traditions that actually help control these fires. So things like that. So I'm have a few few ideas floating around, and I'll continue to explore elementally the possible, you know, climate change as a compositional sort of journey.
To your question, Ollie, yeah, I've got a project which is kind of happening in a different way, trying to spin things out a different way, might find a different way of presenting to catch the eye. I've got a project called The Year Round, which began on the winter solstice. And what I'm doing is I'm bringing out online a song every month, 21st of every month, using poetry, which looks at the small aspects around nature and around times of year, different types of light, different weather conditions, just heightening the kind of sense of the everyday, the inconsequential, but the kind of beautiful and the stuff that we all probably celebrate. But the year seems to go so quickly that we kind of never seem to be able to sort of stop and observe it properly. I mean, we all try, I think, but life gets in the way. So this idea of releasing this thing every month is what I'm doing. So there's one coming out on the 21st of February. It's about nature, but it features one singer every time, same singer, someone I've worked with a lot called Melanie Pappenheim. And we've kind of worked together on this. And every month I also make a film. It's kind of... you can't help yourself, right? you want to try and find a way to signal what you do. And sometimes you also get so involved in the thing that you just can't help doing something, writing your own lyrics or making a film. So that's part of the fun of it, I guess, and part of the personalization that I think is so important with the art making. So that's happening. You can check it out.
Amazing. Thank you. I look forward to seeing all of those in the flesh.